So the plan for today's lecture.
For today's lecture is to quickly finish the screening discussion from last time, and then we'll move on to bosonic systems in condensed matter. So regarding screening, derive this Linard dielectric function. And just to remind you, basically, we just did straight perturbation theory in this induced charge density and assumed that that was small. And just on that basis, to leading order in the perturbation potential, we got this simple expression for the dielectric function. And we now analyze it in a few simple cases to see what it implies. So first of all, let me make the following observation. At low temperature and for small q, the numerator is 0. Unless k is very close to the Fermi level, okay? And how do we see this? Well, we see that from the following sketch. I can sketch the Fermi sphere for you, right? So this is kx and ky. This is kf. And notice what the numerator looks like. So it's a Fermi function of k plus half a q, k minus half a q, and q is small, meaning the two points at which I'm evaluating this Fermi function are nearby, right? And for this to be non-zero, the two values have to be different, right? When they are both, for instance, one, as it would be if both of those momenta were inside the Fermi sphere, then this is zero. When they are both zero, as it would be if both momenta were outside the Fermi sphere, then again, the difference would be zero. The only way the difference is non-zero at low temperature is when, say, k plus q is k plus half a q is inside the Fermi sphere and k minus half a q is outside the Fermi sphere, which means that this k has to be close to the Fermi level. And then the difference here, q, just spans the Fermi surface. And in that case, the difference here will be 2, right? Because one of them is a 0. Sorry, the difference will be 1 because one of them is 0 and the other one is 1. And under these conditions, when k is close to the Fermi level and q is small, one can expand this in the small q. And what one can write then, k plus minus half a q, so we can expand in q. And the expansion looks like this. The leading term is just f of k. That's the term when q is equal to 0. And then the linear term in q has this form. And there are higher order terms in Q that we neglect in this expansion, right? So this term is linear in Q, and there should be a derivative with respect to K here, but I transform that into derivative of mu, and you can check that that is in fact correct. So now, once I have this, I can just substitute these two guys up here in the numerator, and notice that this prefactor here, k dot q over m, is exactly what I have in the denominator, so it will cancel out. Okay, and the expression in that case will simplify, so I have a chi of q approximately equal to, for small q, to minus e squared over volume, sum over k d fk over d mu. Okay? And I want you to look at this for a moment and tell me if this reminds you of something, maybe. So have we seen a result like this?
It looks like the Thomas Fermi result.
Exactly. So this is nothing but the Thomas Fermi result that we derived yesterday. And this is good because, remember, Thomas Fermi approximation was based on the assumption that this potential varies slowly in space, and this is exactly what we should get when we're expanding this. So this does not have that restriction, but when we focus on small q, that means that our potential is varying slowly in space. So it's no surprise that we recover Thomas Fermi. Okay, so this is good. The linear dielectric function in the limit of long wavelengths is consistent with Thomas Fermi. That's what we expect. Now, can we learn something new from this that is not contained in Thomas Fermi? And indeed we can. So that's the second observation. It turns out that at t equals zero, these guys become just step functions, right? The Fermi function at t equals zero, just a step function. And in that case, one can perform this summation exactly by, as usual, going into a thermodynamic limit, writing it as an integral. And it's an exercise that I will not do here. I will just give you the result. So at t equals zero, the k sum can be performed. And the result then looks like this. And when you see the result, again, it will remind you of something. So if you look at this form here, it's exactly the same form as this function capital F that we obtained in Hartree-Fock approximation. And indeed, if you look at this integral, and if you write it down for t equals zero, you would find that it's exactly the same integral that we already did. So that's another reason why I'm not doing it here again. In fact, what this means that in this linear approximation, one can obtain exact result in the limit when the temperature is zero. For non-zero temperatures, one cannot do this integral exactly, but at least in the ground state, this is the result. Now, perhaps you will recall that one comment that we made about this functional form in the context of the Hartree-Fock approximation is that it's non-analytic. This function is non-analytic at x equals 1. So if we call this function f of x, then I told you, or we discovered that f prime at 1 goes to infinity, or rather minus infinity. And that actually has some consequences for the physics of screening. And let me write that down. This is a kind of interesting thing that is observable physically. So because the dielectric function is non-analytic, mm-hmm. at Q equals to Kf, which corresponds to x equals 1 point in that notation, one can show that the screened potential of a point charge has a term at, again, t equals 0, which is when that formula is valid, and at r much larger than inverse Fermi wavelength, that looks like this. Okay. So, interestingly, this non-analyticity that occurs in that function, if you were to calculate with this dielectric function a potential that arises from a test charge, point-like test charge that you put in a metal, you would find that there's a term that at long distances has this power law decay and oscillatory behavior, right? And this is the so-called Friedel oscillations. And these are observable in experiment. This oscillation in the screened potential translate to oscillations also in induced charge, and these can be measured by various techniques. And indeed, it turns out that when you have a metal and you put some say positively charged impurity at the origin and you observe the charge density, then indeed it has this oscillatory profile, and the period of oscillation here actually agrees with what is expected to be the Fermi wave vector. So this is, for instance, rho induced of R has this type of behavior. Once I manage to set up the projection system, I will show you some images of this, but not today. I didn't really bring my computer. So this is a kind of cool prediction that this simple model makes, and indeed is ubiquitously seen in metals. Yes?
You have that the induced charge goes to
zero. Oh, well, I'm just sketching. So this, of course, is valid only at long distances. So something happens here that one should not take that seriously. What one should take seriously is the oscillations at large R.
There is some shift in this.
Typically, there would be a shift. Yeah. So more generally, one can write this that there is some phase that, But the message that I'm driving here is that in addition to the exponential decay that is predicted by Thomas Fermi, Linard has more physics in it, and in addition, it predicts this type of oscillatory behavior, and it looks like this. Sometimes these oscillations in the literature are also called RKKY. Because they were simultaneously discovered by these four gentlemen, Ruderman, Kittel, Kasuya, and Yoshida. Okay, I remember that. So depending on whether you're French, then you prefer Kittel. Friedel. When you're Japanese, you prefer these gentlemen. Anyway, so this is basically it about screening. Are there any questions? Yes.
Can this B be observed in experiments, I mean, this oscillating behavior.
Yes, sure, yeah. And I will show some. The most spectacular are these scanning tunneling microscopy measurements where they take surfaces of simple metals like copper and they evaporate some impurities on top and they can scan with atomic resolution. And whenever you have a charged impurity, you see this beautiful oscillatory behavior that goes for many oscillations. And if you sometimes you might have seen it as when these figures first came out, maybe 15 years ago or so, they were all around the place on Scientific American, had it on the cover and all that. So this is ubiquitously observed these days. Yeah. So before I move on to bosons, I'd like to mention one thing, suggested reading. Fermi liquid theory. And a very nice discussion is given in Ashcroft and Mermin, pages 345 to 351. So Fermi liquid theory is a kind of theory that ties up all these bits and pieces that we discussed about metals, and it's a kind of major accomplishment of the 20th century physics, where Landau, for the first time, have been able to show mathematically why metals really are well described by non-interacting collection of electrons, more or less. This is by no means obvious. If you look at the energy scale of interaction in a metal, it's large. It's not negligible compared to kinetic energy. But nevertheless, when you describe metals as non-interacting, usually you do well. And when you start including interactions naively, such as through Hartree-Fock, you find all these contradictions. And then you have to consider screening and other arguments. And basically, Landau, this was known for many years, and Landau in the 50s showed why this is the case, and you know, the screening and so on is part of that. I don't really have time to go through Fermi liquid theory. That would take many lectures to discuss it properly. But if you're interested, Ashcroft and Mermin in about 6 pages gives you a kind of synopsis and a very nice overview of it. Yes?
Could you recommend a good text for this in terms of the second
quantization? OK. So there's an excellent review article by Shankar that does this properly, right? But it's a 70-page review article which uses some really heavy-duty math like RG and Green's functions and all that. And we teach it at UBC in a kind of second condensed matter class. And it takes about a third of a semester to go through this. So it's one reason why I'm not going through it. Now, the way Landau did it, it's kind of interesting. He, of course, didn't know at that time RG and these techniques. But he substituted for all these techniques his enormous intuition. And when you try to do it the way Landau did it, then it all looks like, OK, so how did he come up with this? And why is this true? But you know, he got it right, although doing it his way is also not extremely easy, I would say. It's a kind of, you have to take lots on faith, and then you have to check that all your assumptions work, and so on. So it's a kind of culmination of this classic condensed matter physics, but we don't have time really to go into it in this class.
Pardon me?
I don't know off the top of my head. It's I can find it for you.
It's Review Modern,
Modern Physics. You type Shankar. It's 90s. That's probably the best way. If you just want a kind of overview, then actually these few pages are pretty good.
The article is very pedagogical because it starts with the conventional renormalization.
But it, you know,
it,
yeah. So it's a,
yeah.
It's a serious investment of time, though, if you want to do it. It's not like something that you can read on Friday afternoon. At least not me. Yeah. Okay, so let me move on. And let's just shift gears. And I move on to bosons, boson systems in condensed matter. So we discussed, well, mostly fermions up to now, electrons, right? Theory of screening and Hartree-Fock and all this was electrons. But bosonic systems play a very important role in condensed matter. And essentially, there's two kinds of bosonic systems that one can discuss. There is systems with real or what one may call fundamental bosons. And these are bosonic particles that whose number is conserved. So for instance, in this category, we would have helium-4, rubidium gas, sodium gas, and so on. And these form quantum liquids that helium-4 has been known for many years. These guys have been made quantum back in 1995 when people started studying cold atom gases. And the important thing, once again, is that the number is conserved. What that means is that helium atom is real in the sense that it cannot appear and disappear at will. So their number, if you put a bunch of helium atoms in a container, that number is constant and cannot change. On the other hand, you have these emergent bosons. Which are no less real than these fundamental bosons, but these emerge as excitations of a solid, and the best known examples are phonons and magnons. Phonons, as you probably know, are quanta of lattice vibrations. Magnons, similarly, are quanta of magnetic fluctuations in solids. And for these, numbers are not conserved. Also, they have no separate existence outside the solid. Whereas if you have a bucket full of helium-4, you can take out the individual atom and examine it, and that's fine. When you have a solid, you have a bunch of phonons inside, but there's no notion by which you can take out an individual phonon and look at it because it's an excitation of the collective system of the lattice vibrations. And similarly for magnons and other emergent particles, there's a fundamental difference between the two. The first class undergoes what is known Bose-Einstein condensation, whereas the second one does not. So here we have BEC. And here, there is other interesting effects. So we need to discuss them separately, although much of the physics is shared. So let me start with this first class, fundamental bosons. I will first review the basics of Bose-Einstein condensation, which you have probably seen in your statistical mechanics class. And then I will lay out what is known as Bogoliubov theory of liquid helium, which shows why, for instance, this at low temperatures, helium-4 becomes a superfluid, and some other things. Okay, so Bose-Einstein condensation. And this is just a brief review. If you've never seen this, then I can suggest some basic statistical mechanics texts. So one starts from Bose-Einstein distribution. which has the following form. N of k is 1 over e to beta epsilon k minus mu minus 1. And this gives you a probability that in a thermal equilibrium, a boson with energy epsilon of k will be in a state with that energy. Okay, and mu is chemical potential as before. This is similar to Fermi-Dirac distribution, except that there is this minus 1 as opposed to plus 1, and that's the difference due to the different statistics of the particles. These are bosons, so they satisfy different commutation rules than fermions. So the total number from here can be written as simply sum over, and now we switch to p for some reason here, but that's fine, np, and this is just sum over 1 over e to beta epsilon p minus mu plus 1, okay? Now, one important point that I would like to stress right away is that we need in this description all these NPs to be. I'm so used to fermions that it's just automatic. Sorry about that. So all these NPs has to be greater or equal to 1 because they give you occupation numbers, right? They cannot be negative. And this immediately implies that mu has to be less than 0 or equal, right? If mu were, so mu is less or equal to 0 for the usual kinetic energy that I will immediately write, which is just h bar squared p squared over 2m, okay?
So why do we have like greater than equal to 1 and
greater than equal to 0? Again. Greater than equal to 0. Yes, I have to focus better. So the occupation numbers have to be greater than 0 because negative occupation number does not make any sense. And because this energy is greater or equal than 0, the smallest value is 0, you can check that these guys, if you put 0 here, and if you were to take non-negative mu, this would lead to something. Well, basically, this exponential would be smaller than 1, and the whole occupation number would go negative. So these are some basic things about bosons that we have to remember. Okay, so with this preparation, one can take this equation and write the following inequality. One can write that the total number is less or equal to sum over p of the same expression, but taken mu to 0. And this is simply because, as you can check, epsilon to beta epsilon p minus mu is always greater or equal than epsilon to beta epsilon p. Okay, and that's an obvious inequality. You can cancel out e to beta epsilon p, and you simply get that this guy is greater than 1, which is true for this condition. So in this sum, if I take every mu, if I take mu 0, every term will be made larger than it actually is, and therefore this inequality holds. So now, notice also that when p is equal to 0, then this denominator diverges, and therefore zero momentum term is really not defined in this sum. And for this reason, let me rewrite this as n of 0. So this is all the particles that are in zero momentum state. And then I sum over p with a prime here of the same thing, e to beta epsilon p minus 1. Okay? So this is sum over all p that is not equal to 0, and for those, this is actually well defined. And now, all I will do, I will rewrite this sum again in thermodynamic limit as an integral, and I rewrite this inequality as follows. This is n naught plus omega over 2 pi cubed, and I will explain what omega is in a moment. Integral from 0 plus to infinity d3k divided by epsilon beta h bar k squared over 2m minus 1. Okay, omega here is the volume. And I'm following this convention because this is what's usually done in the literature on liquid helium, because V is taken by some other thing, which will be the interaction. Okay. So now look at this inequality. And it turns out that this integral here on the right-hand side can be calculated by going to spherical coordinates and I do d3k goes to 4 pi k squared dk. That's the spherical volume element in three dimensions. 4 pi is just the total angular integration. And then I can perform a substitution. X is this expression in the exponential beta h bar k squared over 2m. And what will happen is that this will become a dimensionless integral. I can pull out all the dimensionful factors, and this inequality will become something like this, n naught plus omega beta h bar squared over 2m to minus 3/2 times some constant c. And that constant c is basically just this integral. When I perform a substitution, it's independent of temperature, and that's the important part. And it just doesn't depend on anything. It's just a number. Okay? Does everybody see that? I don't want to do in a great detail. So again, if I make this substitution, this becomes just e to x minus 1. And then I make the same substitution here. But here I can pull out all the factors except for x. So I will end up with an integral that is just a number, right? And all the dimensionful factors are here. Okay, so the important thing to look at is that this part here goes as temperature to power 3/2, because this beta is an inverse temperature. And so I can now plot the situation for you here. Again, I raise this a little bit so that you can see better. So what I'm plotting here as a function of temperature, here is 0. I'm plotting this function, right? So this is function t to 3/2. So I will call this whole thing n prime of t. Okay. So the way you can view this, this represents the number of bosons in the ground state of the system, in the zero momentum state. This then represents all the other bosons, right? And this is the total number of bosons. So what I'm plotting here, this curve, is just this n prime of t. These are all the bosons that are not in the ground state. And if I have some fixed number of bosons, n, that doesn't change with temperature. Those are just my helium atoms or rubidium atoms that I put in at the beginning. And notice what's happening. So this n prime dot t at some point here, necessarily, since it goes to zero, necessarily dips below the total number of particles, right? Which tells me that to satisfy this inequality, I have to put a macroscopic number, n naught, of my bosons into the ground state. Okay? And the lower temperature I go, the larger this number is. And eventually, at t equals zero, all of them will be in the ground state to satisfy this inequality. And that's the phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation. Done kind of in a very quickly and dirty way. If you do this more properly, you don't do this trick with the inequality. You try to solve the equations exactly. But I'm relying on the fact that you've seen this before. So BEC equates to macroscopic number of bosons in the p equals zero state. Okay. And these bosons have some interesting properties. They form a condensate, and we will discuss that now. Now notice that this is not possible for fermions because fermions, their statistics prohibits more than one fermion in a given state. Yes?
Can I even ask about the last argument here? It seems like I understand. Okay.
Any questions? Yes?
So is this Bose-Einstein condensation a gradual process? Or does it happen at some
point? It's a phase transition that, in this simple treatment, it happens at that point that I marked, right? Above it, there is no need to put macroscopic number of bosons in the zero momentum state. Below it, there is. In a more refined treatment, you would find a kind of better expression for that transition. But there is a true phase transition. You cool it down, nothing remarkable happens, and suddenly there's a phase transition, and you see the macroscopic occupation. Any other questions? Okay, so let me move on to now a more detailed discussion of this. And this goes under the name of Bogolyubov theory. Of helium-4. And so one thing remarkable about this phase transition is that it occurs in the absence of any interactions, just because of the Bose-Einstein statistics. Now, of course, this is not what happens in a real system like helium. Those helium atoms actually interact among themselves. And this is what Bogolyubov addressed back in the 50s. So this is actually 1946, so even before 60s. So this is a theory of weakly interacting bosons. And I'm talking about these fundamental number-conserving bosons. The Hamiltonian that Bogolyubov used is the one that we already wrote down before in second quantization, epsilon k, a dagger k, a k, plus, so this is a kinetic energy, which we take to be just a ordinary parabolic dispersion, k, k prime, q, VQ, A dagger, K minus Q, A dagger, K prime plus Q, A K prime, A K. So the interaction term is just like we derived it in our discussion of of second quantization. These are bosonic operators. There is no spin. And VQ here is not Coulomb interaction because helium atoms are neutral, but it's some short-range interaction that these atoms feel when their wave function clouds start overlapping. And we will just keep it general at this point. So let me just remind you that AK prime dagger is delta KK prime, and all the other commutators vanish. AK prime is A dagger K prime is zero. VQ is a Fourier transform of short range interatomic interaction. And epsilon K is just h bar squared k squared over 2m, where m, I will, okay, let me see what I use here. Where m is just the mass of the helium atom. And we will assume from now on weak interaction and low temperature such that most of the bosons are in this condensate. Okay, just a few are excited and will be interested in understanding how these interactions modify the ground state in which everybody is condensed. So under these conditions, we expect ground state or the appropriate thermal state in some sense that is close to the Bose-Einstein condensate, which in second quantized notation looks like this. So this is a ground state of n bosons. And if there were no interaction, this would just be a naught dagger to power n acting on the vacuum, right? So this just puts all my bosonic particles in the lowest energy state. That would be the expression for Bose-Einstein condensate at t equals zero, if there were no interactions. Now, once again, this Hamiltonian that we have here is not exactly soluble because of these interactions here. And Bogolyubov made the following approximations. Yes. No, it's an unnormalized. Well, this is normalized. Yeah, this just gives you a state. Yeah, yeah, this should be normalized, I think. I think this is normalized. But yeah, I can double check this. Yeah, those factors, when we define these operators, they were defined, those factors, square root of n and so on, were chosen precisely so that these types of states remain normalized, I think. Yeah, although there may be different conventions in the literature. And if it's not normalized, then we just normalize it. That's not an issue here. Okay. So basically what Bogolyubov did is the following. He assumed that most, even with interactions, most of these bosons will still be in the ground state. And therefore, A dagger naught, A naught, can be replaced by the expectation value, which is just N naught. Okay? And similarly, he said, okay, this, and this is a key point, A dagger naught, A dagger naught, also can be approximated by N naught. So this is easy to see, right? If you have a state like this and you hit it with this number operator, then you just get this number, right? Because that many particles you have in the ground state. However, this is somewhat less easy to see, and let's just check this. So let me hit this wave function phi naught n with the product of two of those operators. And let me now use the rules that we derived in class before. So I will get n naught plus 1 times n naught plus 2, okay, acting on phi n plus 2 state 0. But since n is macroscopically large, I can forget about these 1 and 2 and say that this is roughly n naught with a very good accuracy. Okay? So this is the Bogoliubov approximation. Basically, he said that since there is macroscopic occupancy of a single state, we can simply, instead of treating this as operators, we can replace them by C numbers, and then only worry about what happens in all the other states that are not at zero energy. Yes?
How do you deal with the fact that
states like you want to zero? So that's the key point. So the ground state, once you include interactions, the ground state will not have a well-defined number of particles. And that's a key thing that one needs to wrap one's brain around. And that's both true in superfluids as well as in superconductors. And I will comment on that because that's a very non-trivial issue. Okay, so this is how we proceed. We don't need to do anything with the first term here. Of course, there is a part where k is equal to 0 here, but this energy also is 0 there, so that term just doesn't really do anything. But in this interaction term, what we do, again, following Bogoliubov, we separate each of these summations into two pieces, one which only has k equals 0 and one where we have everything else, right? And whenever we see terms like this or like that, we immediately replace them by this n naught. Now, it's a bit laborious thing to do because we have three different sums here, and each has to be replaced by a piece that has k equals 0 and everything else. So that's 2 times 2 times 2. That's 8 different terms that one has to analyze. So I will not do this in detail on the blackboard. I will just outline how this is done. So we do this. We separate k into a sum where k is equal to 0 plus sum over k with the prime. And we do the same thing with k prime and with the q summation. Okay, that will result in 8 different terms. And we will then replace a dagger 0, a 0, and a dagger 0, a dagger 0, and a 0, a 0, all by n naught in those terms, right? And finally, we will keep only terms with
at least 1 power of n naught. Okay?
And this is on the account that n dot we expect to be macroscopically large. Let me maybe continue here. So this is what one obtains after this operation. And again, if you maybe you see it right away. If you don't, I encourage you to go over all those 8 terms. There's nothing really very profound about that algebra, but one probably needs to do it once in their life. Okay, so this is what one gets. And let me just write that there are also terms that have no powers of n naught, and we neglect them. So let me write it as terms O1. So these do not have any n, so they would be much smaller than the guys that we kept. So let me just comment on a few terms here. For instance, how you get this first term. Well, this first term arises from the term, obviously, where k is equal to k prime, and this is equal to q, and they are all equal to 0, right? If you do that here in this Hamiltonian, then you get vq of 0, and then everything else is 0, so you basically get n squared from each of those terms, okay? Similarly, this term you would get when k prime is equal to q is 0, but the k is non-zero, right? And again, you can see that that's what you get, and so on. Each term, you can see that it results from this type of decoupling. Also note that what we obtained in this last term are these weird terms that contain AA and A dagger, A dagger. And these are often called Bogolyubov or anomalous terms. Because they don't conserve the number of bosons, right? When you hit the state with n bosons with this, you get a state with n plus 2 bosons. When you do it with this one, you get a state with n minus 2 bosons. So they don't conserve the number of bosons. And of course, the original Hamiltonian did not have that property. The original Hamiltonian perfectly conserves the number of bosons. And what has happened is that in this approximation, where we replace the these products of A0 operators by N naught, we're kind of breaking this symmetry that conserves the number of bosons. And you can think of these processes as being processes such that you have 2 particles, say, at momentum q and momentum minus q, and then they disappear into this condensate, right? So basically, this is a process where 2 particles with opposite momenta meet, and they kind of form 2 particles that now have 0 momentum, right? And then once they have zero momentum, they can disappear into the condensate because they have zero energy, so they rejoin the macroscopic number of particles that are already in the condensate. So that's a feature of these types of theories, like Bogoliubov theory, that they don't conserve the number of particles, but it's not like these particles, these helium atoms, are disappearing, really. They're not disappearing. They are disappearing into the condensate, or this term would describe a process in which two particles just emerge out of the condensate. Any questions about this? Yes? BCS is 1956, so it's about 10 years. This was first.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was, of course, another step, logical step in BCS, that those are fermions, right, electrons. And Cooper had to invent his Cooper pair, which is, in a way, boson. So there was another layer of difficulty in superconductivity, but yeah, we'll discuss that later. Okay, so now our goal is to analyze this Hamiltonian to see what happens. And to this end, let me define a few things just to clean up our notation. I define this quantity eta of k as being n naught times v of k. And I define h bar capital omega k as being epsilon k plus eta k. And again, this just follows the traditional description of Bogoliubov theory that you find in the literature. And also, it turns out one can combine these two terms. Basically, notice that okay, so this describes all the particles in the condensate, whereas this is a number operator for all the particles that are out of condensate. Because of this a prime, there's a summation over all states except zero. So together, when you act with this on the wave function, you should get something on the order of n. And this allows us to actually combine nicely these two terms. And let me show you how this works. So 1 half n naught squared v naught plus n naught v naught sum over k prime a dagger k a k. This is what I call n prime, and I will assume, in keeping with our general philosophy, that this n prime is much smaller than both n and n naught. So this is the assumption that we're very close to BEC ground state. And in that case, 1 half n squared v naught can be expanded as follows: 1 half v naught n naught squared plus twice n naught n prime, but this is sum over k prime a dagger k, a k plus, so on. So basically, the bottom line is that I can replace these two terms by something like this. Where should I continue? So using this expression, I have replaced the sum of these two terms by this. So that's my first term. And then using my definition of omega k and eta k, I have just reorganized all the terms so that my Hamiltonian has this more compact form. And this is often something called Bogoliubov Hamiltonian. Yeah, this is Greek letter eta.
Eta, okay.
Eta.
They are also daggers.
Yes, sorry. There should also be dagger. Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to solve this Bogoliubov Hamiltonian, and if you ask how, then the answer is we solve it by Bogoliubov transformation. So he wrote down this Hamiltonian, and he scratched his head for a while, and then he invented a Bogoliubov transformation. So Bogoliubov transformation is defined as follows. It's basically a rotation in this bosonic space. So I go from A dagger K, AK to alpha K, alpha dagger K, which are also bosonic operators. And I can also invert this transformation. So this is the inverse Bogoliubov transformation. And UK and VK are just some unknown coefficients that we will need to determine. This is the form of the Bogoliubov transformation. I think in the literature sometimes you find you may find minus, but then the relations for these U's and V's are different. Yeah, but the important part is the relation that these U and V have to satisfy for this to remain a canonical transformation. So let's look at that. So we know what the commutation relations for these A's are. They are just listed somewhere up there, over there. We need these alphas to also satisfy bosonic commutation relations. So let's work this out. Alpha K, alpha dagger K prime. And again, this is something that hopefully everybody in the audience can do. I just plug in this on for here, this for there, and I use these commutation relations to work this out. And what I obtain is, after about two lines of work, I get delta kk prime times uk squared minus vk squared. And in order for this to be proper bosons, I need to insist that this is equal to 1. So this implies a condition that uk squared minus vk squared is equal to 1. Now, we will see that a similar transformation also works for fermions. in superconductivity, and there will be a plus sign between the two. And technically, the differences between symplectic and unitary transformation, this is symplectic, the other one is unitary. But maybe for these purposes, this is not super important. In this context, alpha dagger k, alpha k, are called quasi-particle operators. They represent creation and annihilation operators of what is called quasi-particles, and these are going to be excitations of the ground state of the system. And in condensed matter physics, quasi-particles are everywhere. So this is maybe the first quasi-particle that we encounter in this context. So what we want now, we want to determine these coefficients u and v that satisfy this condition, such that after the transformation, our Bogoliubov Hamiltonian is diagonal, right? Namely, H is written in these new coordinates, is H bar omega k alpha k dagger alpha k plus some ground state energy that will just be a constant. Okay, so we want to find u and v that give us this. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, it's quite simple. Basically, we write this alpha dagger k alpha k in terms of A's through this inverse Bogoliubov transformation, and then see if we can find a match such that these U and V's give us back that Hamiltonian, right? If we can find that match, then we're good, and indeed it is possible. Otherwise, I wouldn't be really presenting this. So again, let's just work this out. AK dagger, alpha K dagger, alpha K, I take this times that and multiply it out, and I get an expression like this. I get two terms, uk squared a dagger k ak plus vk squared a minus k a dagger minus k, and I get a second line where I have the mixed terms uk vk times a minus k ak plus a dagger k a dagger minus k. Okay? So this looks promising because we see that indeed at least the structure is good, right? Over there I have terms like this and I have terms like that, so I should be able to match these coefficients or to find these coefficients u and v such that the Hamiltonian is the same. I need to, so the second term looks good. The first term looks not quite right because over there I just have this first term, not the second one. So what I do, I will make the following assumption, which I will check later on, that is correct. So I will assume that omega minus k is omega k, and also that v minus k squared is vk squared, and I will check this. Right, so far this omega k, uk, and vk are unknown coefficients. I can assume that they satisfy that, and if the final solution actually is like that, then I'll be fine. And you can see why I'm assuming that. Basically, when I put this here in the sum, in the second term, I want to change my dummy variable k to minus k, and then I will get v minus k omega minus k in that term. So I want to declare them to be equal to be symmetric like that, so that I can do everything correctly. So with that, let me just look at, again, this thing here, h bar omega k, alpha dagger k, alpha k. When I do this operation, then I end up with the following, sum over k h bar omega k uk squared plus vk squared a dagger k ak plus a term that is just h bar omega k vk squared. This is just that constant which I can dump into this, so I don't care about that so much. And then I get the final term, which I just copy here, h bar omega k uk vk ak a minus k plus a dagger k a minus k with a dagger. Okay, so now when I compare this with my Hamiltonian here, I see that all the terms are here. And in order for them to actually be equal, I have to equate this coefficient to the first coefficient out there and one half of this coefficient to the second coefficient over there. So let me do just that and finish this calculation. So basically, I have two conditions when I match this to that Hamiltonian. I have a condition that h bar omega k uk squared plus vk squared is equal to h bar capital omega k. So again, this is matching this first term to the first term over there. And then I have to match the second term. And here I get twice h bar omega k uk vk, and this is equal to eta of k. So I have these two equations for two unknowns, but I also have to ensure that they satisfy this condition so that this is a legitimate canonical transformation. And the simplest way to do that is actually to square both of these and subtract them. So I square and subtract. And you can see what will happen. I will have an overall term, h bar squared omega k squared, which is common to both of these. And then I will have a uk squared plus vk squared squared minus 4 times uk squared vk squared. And this is equal to h bar squared omega k squared minus eta k squared. But this thing here actually is simply uk squared minus vk squared squared. And this is equal to 1 by our assumption. So from this, finally, I get that h bar omega k is equal to square root of h bar squared omega k squared minus eta k squared. And this is what is often called Bogoliubov spectrum of excitations. One can now use these equations to solve for also uk and vk. I will not do that. You will do that in the next tutorial. I will just go ahead and discuss some physics now based on what we just found. So, physical consequences. Okay, so let me massage this spectrum a little bit. Let me just recall that eta of k is v naught vk, and epsilon k is h bar squared k squared over 2m. Then I can write that quasi-particle spectrum as h bar omega k square root epsilon k plus n naught v of k. It's the same expression, yes.
Do we have to take the positive square root?
Do we have to what?
Take the positive square root of the
negative. Oh, you mean there, the minus sign. Yeah, so what we want is positive energy excitations above the ground state. So we want to take just a positive positive square root. Okay. So let's just now check various limiting cases in the last 10 or so minutes. So one simple case is to take, so the question now is what do we take for this interaction, right? We did this in complete generality, but now the spectrum of our Hamiltonian depends on what we take for these excitations. So the simplest thing that one can take is contact repulsion. Namely, V of R is some U times delta of R. And this maybe is not a bad approximation for atoms, right? Where they interact only when they overlap very closely. The Fourier transform of this VK is just U over omega for all K. Right, Fourier transform of a delta function is just a constant. And in this case, then h bar omega k is basically this. It's epsilon k plus 2 n naught over omega times V. And if I call this whole thing E naught for simplicity, then I can analyze this in two different limits. Namely, this becomes a square root or proportional to square root of epsilon k, which is proportional to just absolute value of k when epsilon k is much smaller than E naught, right? When epsilon k is much smaller than this, then I can neglect this epsilon k and just look at this one. So this is going to be proportional to square root of epsilon k, which goes just like a linear spectrum. However, this will go as epsilon k when epsilon k is larger than E naught. So here I get a quadratic dispersion. Okay. Now this is interesting, especially this first piece. So we're getting linear dispersion. So this is like a sound mode rather than a particle mode, right? Whenever you have massive particles, the dispersion is quadratic, which occurs here at high energies, but at low energies, we get this sound-like dispersion or light-like dispersion. So this behaves more like waves than particles. So at low energy, we find linear
sound like dispersion. And this will be important for the theory of superfluidity. This, in a way, explains this superfluidity.
That's the same thing as saying that the effective mass of the exhalation is zero.
Yeah, you can say it that way. Yeah. So now let's look at a slightly more realistic case. So typical interaction. For helium 4 has finite range, right? Namely, if you were to plot Vk as a function of k, it has some finite range, so it would not, previously for contact repulsion, we had a constant, right? That was this constant, but if the interaction has a finite range, then it will look something like this, where this typical scale is a naught minus 1, and this a naught minus 1 is the range of that interaction, which is roughly the size of the electronic cloud of that helium atom. So then it goes zero. It goes to zero slowly. Now, if you were to plug in this type of dispersion into this equation, this is not so easy to do analytically, but you can convince yourself that the dispersion looks like this, h bar omega k as a function of k. It starts again linearly, but then it has this dip, and then it goes up quadratically. So this part goes like k, this part goes like k squared. And if you were to compare it with just a pure quadratic dispersion, it would look like this. And this sometimes is called a Roton minimum. And this has some historical connotations that I don't have time to go into. But the point is, this type of spectrum is actually experimentally observed in liquid helium. Or more accurately, various experiments done on liquid helium are consistent with this type of spectrum. And so this gives us some confidence that this Bogoliubov theory actually works well. Okay, so I would like to finish this today, and I have one last argument to make. So let me go through that, and I should be done in about 5 minutes that we have. So this is the Landau argument for superfluidity in helium 4. And it's actually a very appealing argument, very simple, almost classical argument. And this is how it goes. So liquid helium is observed to be superfluid, namely it flows without dissipation through narrow channels. If you plunk something into it, it doesn't dissipate. So it turns out the best way to address this theoretically is to imagine that you have a vessel filled with helium 4 that is in this state. And then you imagine you have a massive object, a pebble or something, that moves at a velocity v through this medium. And you analyze the way how this energy and momentum of this object can dissipate, right? And the way it can dissipate is that it radiates out these quasi-particles, h bar, like this. So these are the quasi-particles k, because these are the only excitations that are available, right? So it moves through a medium,
its low energy excitations are these quasi-particles that we discussed. So the only way that energy can be dissipated is by radiating these excitations. Now, let us write equations for conservation of energy and momentum in these processes. Okay? So conservation of energy is simple. So this is a body of mass m. It has velocity v at the beginning, and then after it radiates out one of these quasi-particles, it has a velocity that is modified, and we need to account for the energy of that quasi-particle, right? So this is conservation of energy. And similarly, we can analyze conservation of momentum, like we learned in high school, maybe, although maybe not with liquid helium. So this is conservation of momentum. And then I will just massage these equations and show you that they cannot be satisfied at low velocities and high masses. So the object will not be able to dissipate any energy because it cannot satisfy these conservation laws. So what I do, I will square this equation and express it like this, m.
I divide by 2m and express this b dot k times h bar once again, I divide by 2m, and then I express this. What appears on the other side is just the basically difference between the two energies, right, which I replace by h bar omega k from energy conservation. And that comes in. This term is just that term after I divide it by 2m. Okay, so combining these two equations, I get. Now I look at this equation and notice the following. This term here can be written like this, h bar squared k squared over 2 little m, where little m is the mass of the helium atom, m, little m divided by capital M. And if this is a pebble, I'm throwing in a macroscopic object, then this ratio will be something like 10 to minus 24, right? Because that pebble will have 10 to 24 roughly atoms in it, whereas one helium atom has just mass that is small. So if you think about it, this term, because of this fact, will be utterly negligible compared to these two terms. These two terms are some microscopic scale. This is the energy of one of these quasi-particles. This is momentum of one of these quasi-particles. So those are microscopic scales, whereas this one is by microscopic scale times this tiny number. So I can safely neglect this thing here, and then I can look at how can I satisfy this equation, and it turns out that at small velocity, I cannot really satisfy that equation. So let me show that graphically as a function of momentum. I plot the left-hand side, and it's just a straight line as a function of k. And let me imagine that I'm radiating at some angle theta, so this will be h bar b cosine of that angle theta, whereas the left-hand side, the right-hand side is just h bar omega k, so that's that dispersion over there. Right? So this dispersion will look something like this, h bar omega k, and when this velocity v is small enough, then I see that there's no solution. The only solution here is at zero, but that doesn't help me because zero momentum particles don't help me dissipate energy. I want finite momentum, finite energy. So the bottom line of the Landau argument is that for v less than some critical velocity, there can be no dissipation. And this implies superflow. So according to this theory, at low velocities, the body can move through a superfluid medium without any dissipation. And indeed, this is observed. It's also observed that when you try to push the body at a higher velocity, above some critical velocity, which is typically a few centimeters per second, then you start dissipating until the velocity drops below this critical velocity, and at that point, it again starts moving without dissipation. So, and notice that absolutely crucial, and this is my last point, I'm sorry to keep you over time, but we started a bit late. Absolutely crucial for this is the fact that we have this linear part in the spectrum at low energies, right? If the spectrum was quadratic, then there would be always a solution to that equation, because quadratic dispersion, right? At low momenta, the quadratic function is always smaller than a linear function. Right? So this linear piece that follows from this theory is absolutely superfluid. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
Is it possible to do all of this while conserving your particles?
It is possible, and the eminent scientist who insists on this is Tony Leggett, who obtained a Nobel Prize for some other things. So, unfortunately, so you can do all this in a number conserving way. Unfortunately, the price you pay for this is that it's very complicated. So, here's the book, which you're welcome to look through, and I went through it. But really, so the bottom line is you can formulate this whole thing without violating the number of particles, but you have to do these crazy things that nobody is willing to do. And it looks like the Bogoliubov theory as written kind of agrees with that experiment despite its unappealing feature that it doesn't conserve the number of particles.
Can you do it well enough that it returns the same like results, like it agrees with Bogoliubov theory and everything?
Yeah. So to the extent that you can solve these Leggett equations, which you only can do in some special cases because they're very complicated, the results agree with this, right? And you cannot really solve them in all the cases that you would like because they are much more complicated. Any other questions? Okay. So thanks again for your attention. Have a nice weekend. Go play in the snow, and I see you all on Monday.
So.